Well, good morning for our last lecture and conversation about this example. An announcement before I forget that I have told some of you. I am certain, or 95% confident, let me say, in the English language sense, that the biostatistics courses for next year will have the longitudinal data class 242C in the fall, and it will be Alan Hubbard who, together with Nick Jewell, for years have been taking their course material and eventually working towards a book. The good thing about this is the students in 242C now get these beautiful LaTeX documents that have the chapters of the book for free instead of paying $100 for them when it finally gets published. But it's excellent material. It builds on what we've been doing in the last couple weeks, although Alan does it a little more mathy. It's a project-based course so that if you can hang out with the math notation, I don't think you're going to have to sit in class, close book, and do derivations. But he does a little more presenting. So get your algebra cross-training ready for that. I regret the way our department handles things. It's not as bad as the time we had to make changes in the schedule in August. But I know you've started telebears. So stay tuned for that. And for those of you who are thinking about 245, I would love to have you in class again. If you sit down and say, well, I have to take EPI 250B, I don't know if I can handle 200 level biostat classes in stereo, or I'm going to look at a class that's not one of these 8 o'clock Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, I would still be happy to talk with you in little moments about your research. A number of you have projects that are going to be continuing, and I've been delighted that you've used the class to start getting the skills you're going to need for the future. Because, of course, the point of this is not just putting a good grade on your transcript, but getting you skills that will help you read papers and analyze data. The last couple weeks of this course have been kind of challenging, and the notation's been a little heavier, but several of you have articles using these ideas, so I think it's really worth spending a little more time on this second example. And the JMP folks have helped me fix my spelling of the pteromaxillary, not mixillary. So next year, that will show up. But, you know, I appreciate these things because how else am I going to learn? So this is an important application where we've measured these children at 4 time points. And given the way the plots look, trying to project a trajectory into their future looks a little daunting based on these data. And also, we pointed out last time a very practical thing to think about is that there's probably measurement error in these responses because I doubt the distances get shorter. Okay, so that's got to be random error. But we started out looking at this, and we're going to set up a model that in the modern jargon is called a random intercept, which means that each subject has a distinct starting level. And we are assuming that these boys and girls are a simple random sample from a large number of folks who are going to need this kind of treatment. So we're going to have a random subject effect. A random slope model would allow each child to have their distinct growth pattern over time, and you need a heck of a lot of data to allow each child to have not only their own starting point, but their own slope. What we're going to do instead is we are going to take a look at gender as a fixed effect and we're going to allow for gender time interaction because the growth slope may be different for the boys and the girls, and a practical reason for that might be timing of pubertal growth spurts. We also will be thinking in this example as the ages 8, 10, 12, and 14 as a fixed effect. So when you read about models like this, what I've done here is putting up again the random effect and the fixed effect terms is show you why these things are sometimes called XT mixed, mixed models. So if you read a paper that says we used hierarchical mixed models to analyze the data, it's a model like this or an extension because we have some random effects and some mixed effects. Much of the setup of this example is like what we did with the women and the calcium levels. I just think it's worth seeing a second example, particularly since we're not going to have you do one of these yourselves in the homework. So if you kind of got what we were doing with the calcium effect, that's sort of the same thing. In all of these models, we start out making big assumptions about the random effects. We have them assumed as normal curve. And when we did this kind of model in homework 4, we had you practice plotting the averages for each clinic on a Q-norm plot to see if that kind of assumption is reasonable. If you want to figure out how to do the plotting for both levels of randomness, I really recommend that you come into 340B and take a look at the very nice multi-level and hierarchical models book. And the nice thing is they use Stata for their main computing. So you'll see Stata output in there, and then you can put it to work in Stata. But one of the themes of our course is we need to take assumption checking very seriously. And so if you look at page 409, there's lots of assumptions and lots of Greek letters. But the short story is everything is assumed independent. The different children don't have any correlation. And more crucially, the two levels of random effect don't have any correlation. That the starting point for the children is not going to be related to the measurement errors. Now, you have to ask yourself always as practical people, I can't tell you which way this goes medically, but a child who starts out with the larger head might have a different measurement variability than a young person who starts out with a relatively small head. Whatever they're doing to measure these internal skull distances, assuming that the random variability for the smaller folks is the same as the random variability for the larger folks, or that it's the same epsilon for the child over, same variability of the epsilon for the child over 4 time points. I don't know if it gets easier or harder to get a fix on this distance, depending on head size, but that would be a practical reason why just putting down there's one sigma squared epsilon might be in practice violated. I don't know that we have enough data here to check that, but part of the critical thinking I've tried to develop with you is for you to say, well, wait a minute. Does the sigma squared epsilon change either as they get older or if it's a smaller size or a larger size regardless of age? That's where these assumptions might kind of get a problem. But people do make these, and then the challenge for me is, especially if you have a larger, richer data set, is to ask the statistician on your committee, how do I check these? Because we want to get a standard error that gives us the correct margin of error for our confidence intervals. You might say to me, well, why do I have to worry about sigma mu and sigma epsilon? I think the bottom line answer is standard error calculations based on constant variance assumptions only give you usable tests and confidence intervals if the assumptions hold approximately. And, you know, you've all worked really hard this year, and if you think about what you knew in the middle of August last year and what you know now, it's a lot. But in order to kind of meet my goal of equipping you to interact with statisticians, saying to them, well, what are the assumptions and how do we check them, is really, really important. So what we're going to do is start with a couple of different ways of modeling these data and see what we can learn about patterns in the outcome measure varying with age and gender of the children. They're 8-year-old when they start. We can call them children. So at the top of page 410, I am starting out with age as continuous and linear. And I think it's always a good idea when someone says to you, well, I'm going to take age as continuous, that you explicitly add the and linear, because you want to allow for the possibility that if it's not linear in age, it might be quadratic. So we'll put both of those down. And I am looking at an indicator I called girls. I generally like to make my gender indicators tell me who's the one rather than just calling it gender or sex, because when you're stressed and trying to interpret, it's a little easier. Okay? And then I have a cross product, literally the age times girls. And the first thing I want to look at in the model on page 410, as we did when we did our little simpler analysis of covariance, I want to start with a test on the age girls cross product before I look at the other coefficients. And you have to keep saying to yourself over and over, whether it's this model or some of the other ones we've done, you can't do a whole lot with those quote, main effect terms when you have cross products in the model. The slope on age in that top model on page 410 is the age slope for the boys. We have a slope estimate of 0.784 for the boys because that's when girl equals zero. And then we have a slope estimate of 0.784 minus 0.305, if I round it, to 3 digits for the girls. Okay, so this is something we've been practicing since homework 4. And the good news is, even though the XTReg and XTMixed are more complicated model fitting, if you got the interpretation of the cross products down in homework 4, this still holds. And of course, what I want to ask myself, is this different from zero? And with the way we've parameterized the model, you have a pretty immediate answer to that. All you have to do is, because this just depends on one variable and not several, is the answer to the question, is the slope for the boys different from the slope for the girls, comes down to looking at the z-test on age girls. I don't even have to do a test command here. I have all the information I need in the output. Why is it a z and not a t? Because we're in a maximum likelihood context, essentially. So it's telling us that we do have evidence that the slope for the girls is different from the slope for the boys, or I think it's fine if you're careful to say it's less than the slope for the boys. So if our investigators are really interested in these two parameters, what we want to do is not only report those point estimates, but we also want to take a look at the confidence intervals. We can read a confidence interval for the slope on boys directly from the output, right? Because it just involves that one parameter. So the 95% confidence interval for the slope on the boys is from the output 0.634 to 0.934. And I think these are in millimeters and the units are year. So that's kind of what we would get. The 95% confidence interval for the slope on the girls, well, I had to take two parameters from the model and add them. And the coefficient estimates in these models, in general, are correlated. So if you want to get the variance of x plus y for the general case, it's the variance of x plus the variance of y plus twice the covariance of the two random variables. And we're going to apply that in this context to our coefficient on age and our coefficient on the cross product. Now, we'll actually show you how to get in there and calculate this for yourself in 245. It's not horrible if it just involves two model terms. But this little bit of additional background is why you want to get really good with the LINCOM command, where you tell Stata the names of the variables whose coefficients you want it to work with. So you'll see that I have that LINCOM command on page 410. And it tells me that the 95% confidence interval for the slope on the girls in the LINCOM output, all I have to do is say I've got 0.299 to 0.660 millimeters per year. And some of you have asked me good questions about this. Those confidence intervals overlap. The upper limit on the confidence interval for girls, that 0.660, is greater than the lower limit on the confidence interval for boys. But that's not the correct way to ask yourself if the slopes differ. The test on the age times girls tells us we've got evidence that the slopes differ. And then just to be explicit about what I just said, even though the confidence intervals overlap, so you have to be careful because you'll even have professors make a mistake on this. If the confidence intervals didn't overlap, then I could probably say, yeah, the test on the cross product will not be negligible. Okay, if the confidence intervals didn't overlap at all, the test on the cross product would probably have a really tiny p-value. But to make, again, a point sort of setting you up to do well in the future, I can't tell by looking at those two confidence intervals and that they overlap some that that means the slopes could be the same. Because when I get a p-value on a cross product of 0.011, that's a pretty low p-value for a cross product test. So don't make your judgments when you're reading a paper if they just comment that the confidence intervals overlap. You got to ding them and say, where was the interaction test? And it's common, even with papers published in the last 10 years, that people won't give you an explicit test for interaction when you know, you guys in your second class in statistics know how to do it, so it's not that hard. Okay, but just to kind of make as many sending you out into the future teaching points, this is a good example in which to make that comment. Do we want to do anything with the inter-class correlation here with the row? Well, the things I have here about the slopes are probably the main tool from this analysis that our investigators need if they're really going to try to project how the distance is going to be when these children are adults. You also know from the very first example that we did that getting accurate prediction intervals is the most difficult challenge for a linear model. And I would bet that with only 27 children, these folks are not going to have useful information that will help them look at their data and get an accurate confidence interval for the adult measurements. We did that in our simpler problems, and that would probably be something we would want to do here. However, just to push the interpretation a little bit, the intra-class correlation, the rho, is the correlation on the observations from the same subject. And the thing about using XT reg is XT reg assumes that we have an exchangeable, which is why we might want to expand this and to use a GEE to see how things look. The other thing I want to sneak in here as a little bit of alternative for you for the future is that the reg command, the regular old regression with the newer option, you would say VCE cluster ID number, gives the same coefficient pieces, but it doesn't do estimates of the sigma rho and sigma epsilon. But if you take a look at page 411, this is another thing you can do. If there's just one level of the repeated measures, you can kind of do this. Quite often in a model like this with fixed effects, unlike homework 4 where it's all random effects, our investigators are probably more interested in their fixed effects than they are in their random effects. The other reason I want to point this out is I've seen papers get this wrong. When you use this cluster option, you are not doing what is called a cluster analysis, but I can see why people would make that mistake. We're going to do a little bit of cluster analysis in 245. Cluster analysis says, dear computer, take these measurements on all these individuals and sort it out and tell me if they're subgroups. But it's hard because when you see something published and they say, well, we did the regression and we used the cluster analysis, it's like, no, they probably did this kind of option. But you'll see the people who are getting measured repeatedly called a cluster, and it's just kind of like a context-specific thing. What about this model with the linear trend? Should we take a look at modeling our data, allowing three indicators, particularly if there's a growth spurt? It looked in the graph that the girls were pretty linear, but just like you're doing with the rabbits, it looks like the function for the boys has a kink in it. So we might want to implement this using the model on page 412, where we looked at indicators for all of our groups. And I basically took a look at two ways of testing for interaction that you may have seen in the context of this model. The context for testing a set of cross products is either maximum likelihood, which you have to do some things in Stata to store your estimates, or the wall test, which is implemented in Stata in the test command. Generally, they give you very similar results, but one of the reasons I want to spend a few minutes with you on the model on page 412 with the cross products is now I have a set of three cross products for the age times gender because I am no longer just using one common slope. So at the bottom of page 412, I have the wall test where I just fit the model and then I clicked on those three fun cross products from Stata, and it tells me that the wall test for interaction here has a p-value of 0.0538. And that's larger than the p-value we had on the age times girls. It's still pretty small for an interaction test p-value. I would not ignore that, even though it's slightly greater than 0.05. But story is, if you, quote, parameterize the age-gender interaction differently, you're going to get a slightly different test. This one makes less assumptions, but it uses three parameters instead of one. The likelihood ratio test, if we go through how to save the likelihoods from the two models we fit, the likelihood ratio where you have to save the estimates, the LR test at top of page 413, of course, is going to give me a little different p-value. This one is about 0.0626. So they're not mathematically identical, but they are asymptotically equivalent. And however we do the interaction test with the indicators and the likelihood ratio, or the indicators and the wall test, or the linear, we've got a pretty strong signal that we do need a different slope for the boys and the girls. So the last thing I did with, yeah? Mm-hmm. You don't want to do that. You don't want to look at those until you've done the overall test. So what Alice is pointing out to me is the cross product on the first two age and gender variables have p-values of 0.885 and 0.212. So if you wanted to say, what's the Jeopardy question, what does that answer? I think it's saying that the slope for the 8 to 10-year-olds, which is what the first indicator would code, might not be different. Okay, then the second indicator here codes the difference between the 12-year-old and the 8-year-old, right? Because the 8-year-old is going to be the baseline. So the second one says if I look at the difference between the 12-year-old and the 8-year-old measurements for the girls and boys, I don't have evidence that those differences vary by gender. When I go to the difference between the last measurement at 14 and the measurement at 8, that's the third cross product with the 0.025. If you want to know what to conclude globally, test all three. And I don't know, it would depend on the context for the investigators. Would it be helpful to you to know that the slope differences emerge when they get into their teens? That maybe between 8 and 12, I have no evidence that the slopes are very different. I think it's probably a little safer to say, I'm not going to bet on that. What the person saying, well, okay, why don't we use a common slope between 8, 10, and 12 for boys and girls? First of all, with this size sample, they could be making a type 2 error. Secondly, saying, well, I've got one model for 8 to 12, and then when they get to 12 to 14, I have to change to a separate slopes model. Remember that our investigators here really want to project. And so it's a really good question. This might even show up in the lecture next year if I make a note. It's kind of mixed. If I just cared about 8 and 10-year-olds, maybe I wouldn't need two slopes. And I think this is true with a number of physiological things about children, is that you don't need different models for the kids when they're younger, or at least it's an empirical question. But my general advice, we'll just kind of add this, I sort of really ding the students if they start looking at the tests on the individual indicators before they look at the overall test, partly because it's kind of a multiple comparisons thing. So you're sitting here saying to me, well, two of those are really high, and I agree with you. They're both greater than 0.20. What should I make of the whole deal? It's kind of like the thing we did in the homework with the hay fever pills. Part of the graph looked kind of parallel, and the other part didn't. And then we said globally, overall, there is interaction. And I think that would be a good thing here, particularly if they want to play it forward. Using separate slopes for the boys and the girls, I think, would really be a good thing. Because we're saying that the difference between 8 and 10 looks not significantly different for the boys and girls, but that last indicator and cross product would code the difference between 14 and 8. So 14 and 8 have distinct differences. So I would just go with, I don't want to do any of them the same. But it's a good question. There's a medical aphorism that I learned from some of my friends that particularly goes something like, nothing is always and nothing is never except protect the airway, which means you don't want your patient to die from, you know, not getting oxygen while you're treating them. And that for most other things, there can be context differences or differences according to what you want to do with these data. And I think these data are not so much studying the growth patterns of the children in the past, it's trying to project forward. Okay, there are lots of things we could do with these data. There's just one little thing we can take a look at, and then my fascination with correlation structures we can set aside. But page 414 does something very similar to what I'm having you do in homework 5. So it might be useful to take a little look at page 414, where basically a question we should have, given a look at the models we have today, is we would like to compare the linear slope on age model, which is kind of nice, it only has one parameter for the boys and one for the girls, to a indicator for age model. And the way I put that question kind of practically at the top of page 414, instead of using a constant slope for age, are there growth spurts? And it's a little tricky to do here, but basically we're going to take a look at this and see how those two models line up. So for the boys, we had the constant slope if we use just one slope. That came out to be this 0.78 millimeters per year. And the only reason I put a ridiculous amount of significant digits there, cutting and pasting, is so that you could see where I was getting the numbers in the output. Okay, but even given the data, 0.78 would be fine. So with the indicators, what the indicator model says for the boy is the change from the 8 to 10 years gives us 0.9375 millimeters over a 2-year span. Or if I divide that in half, it's about 0.47 millimeters per year. So if you look at the overall slope of 0.78, that's bigger than what you would get for 8 to 10 by dividing that. And then if you look at the change from 8 to 12, because that would be the next indicator, And the cross products are all zero, so I can read the boys out fairly easily. The change for 8 to 12, if you look at the coefficient on that indicator, it's 2.84 in 4 years. So if I divide that down, I think I got this right. It's about 0.95 millimeters per year when I'm considering those two numbers, which is quite a bit different than the 0.47 and also is different from the constant slope of 0.78. So my question here is, do you feel that the 0.78 as an experienced data analyst is a good compromise between 0.47 and 0.95? And I hope you'll say, at least qualitatively, even before we take a look at a likelihood ratio test, that I might not want to use one slope because there's some indication here, at least qualitatively, there's slower growth from 8 to 10 than there is overall from 8 to 12. And this is a good model of how to take a look at these models and figure out, do I want to have a linear term in age, or do I get more information if I take the indicator approach, which makes no functional form? So my sort of closing comment on this is, if your advisor says to you, well, let's take age continuous in our model because we'll get more power, the Maureen hook on that is true. It took them three indicators here instead of one slope. But the big if is the linear is more powerful if you get the functional form correct. The good thing about the indicator models is you don't have to make those kinds of functional forms. But like many other things in life, using statistics requires a lot of trade-offs. So I'm going to be not available next week. I'll have email if you have questions you think I can answer over email. But I've set aside 4 hours of day of office hours on the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of exam week. The due date for the papers is Thursday the 10th. I think most of you know me well enough now that I will say to you, the universe will not collapse if you have to give me your paper a day or two later. I would like to get them and start grading them. You know, I can't get 40 papers on Friday the 11th, but if it makes a big difference in the quality of your work, talk to me by email, because you guys have done a tremendous amount of work this semester, and I want you to be able to go out after investing in all this and use it